This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
Dr. Saltman, if a head teacher is listening now on his or her Easter break, and they have young people who think that they might be possibly go off to IS, how should they react?
Well, there's actually already systems in play for reporting young individuals that are under concern of extremist tendencies or are thought to have undergone radicalization. In local communities, there's different prevent strategies where actually they have community leaders meet with religious leaders and parents to talk about what they think that means and what that threat is. But the idea that we're going to have a huge swarm of students over the Easter break and that we should fear that's a concern that is not necessarily warranted. We've seen some trends happen recently, and there is a concern, but actually just having an awareness and having parents be more aware of what they should look for and how they should talk to their children makes a huge difference in this case.
But aren't you concerned that head teachers don't want to see their children possibly being criminalized? Surely if they think that one of their pupils is about to head off to Syria, the police need to know as soon as possible, don't they?
Well, it depends what they're seeing within their students. We've seen a lot of websites from different governments, the UK government, the French government, try to outline how to view their students and what you might see as radicalizing trends. But actually, in the young people that we've seen make this journey or be stopped at borders, there was very little signage of what that was. There was very little awareness. And there is reluctance for both parents and teachers to turn in children to authorities that they think are then going to perhaps ruin their life choices if they're prosecuted. What we need to see is actually more NGOs. We need to see better groups that are not directly attached to security forces to be in the first phases of helping these young people.
How would those NGOs work in practical terms?
Well, we do see some groups that already exist within cities like Jan Trust in the UK or some others, where they're the first point of call to actually talk about what the concern is, what are the trends we're seeing, because many times these young people, parents might be afraid, and yet this fear is perhaps not founded, or there's just signs that many of us see as just teenager signs that have also been listed as what you should be concerned about for radicalization. So it's about getting our information straight.
Bit of Russian roulette, though, lastly, isn't it? High stakes, Doctor.
Well, I think that we already see in place NGOs working with governments, and to directly take minors and turn them into authority, that's a very traumatic and harsh event. When we look at the statistics of who's going over, although we have seen the recent trend, it's unprecedented to see such young individuals radicalized. To make everyone fear that all of our young people are radicalized right now is not really founded.
All right. Thanks for your input, Dr. Ellen Saltman, your senior counter-extremism researcher at the Institute of Strategic Dialogue. In what is seen as a toughening of Labour policy that will further complicate the party's relationship with business. Rachel Reeves, Shadow Work and Pensions Secretary, joins me now. So are we saying, Rachel Reeves, all zero-hour contracts are wrong?
Good morning, Nick.
Morning.
What we're saying is if you work regular hours, then you deserve a regular contract. And after 12 weeks, if you've been doing regular hours, you'd be entitled to just that. So after 12 weeks, people have that right to that security that is offered by a contract with regular hours.
To whom and how many people does this apply, do we imagine?
Well, there are 1.8 million zero-hour contracts in the economy. It's a 20% increase in a year ago. So this is a good number of people, a good number of jobs affected by this. And it will ensure that those people who are currently have no security day by day or week by week of how many hours they're going to do or how much money they're going to take home, whether they're going to be able to pay the rent and the bills, will be giving them that security.
How embarrassing, looking at other front pages this morning, Rachel Reeves, how embarrassing is the front page of the Daily Telegraph, 100 business leaders saying that Labour, your party, would threaten Britain's recovery?
Well, the letter to the Telegraph doesn't mention the Labour Party. The letter calls for lower taxes for big businesses. And I don't think it would be a surprise to many people that big businesses want their taxes to be lower. But we've made it clear that our priority is tax cuts for ordinary workers and for smaller businesses to ensure that as the economy recovers, it benefits everybody in society, not just a few at the top. And that is our priority.
Well, it says, and I'm sure you've had sight of it, we believe this this is, I'm quoting from the letter, we believe a change in course will threaten jobs and deter investment. They might not spell it out with the Labour Party, but they laud the work of the Conservative-led government. It's clear what these men and women think. Well, it's very embarrassing for you, isn't it? You've even got people such as Sir Charles Dunstan and others who have been past Labour supporters who now would appear to have changed allegiances. How do you feel about that?
Well, we've said, Nick, that we want to maintain the most competitive rate of corporation tax in the G7, the same rate of corporation tax that we had last week, last month and last year. And that is a commitment that we've made to big businesses. We've also made that commitment,
well,
of course, that we won't stay in the European Union.
They?
Well, the businesses today have signed a letter which is specifically about corporation tax. And as I say, I don't think it'll be surprising to people that bigger businesses want to see their taxes cut. But our priority is a tax cut.
It's about investment and job creation.
Our priority is about helping those smaller businesses. 1.5 million smaller business premises will benefit from our cut and then freeze in business rates. We think that that's the right priority to ensure that smaller businesses as well get a fair deal and see a cut in their taxes. That's Labour's priority.
Who once wrote, once you lose the chief executives, you lose more than a few votes, you lose your economic credibility? Who said that?
Well, I'm sure you can tell me.
Tony Blair.
That's great. Thank you.
So now that I'm grateful, I'm here to help. So now that you've lost the chief executives, you've lost, in the views of Tony Blair, in the view of Tony Blair, you've lost economic credibility.
Well, if you talk to smaller businesses, and I'm off to West Yorkshire later today to speak to a manufacturing company and the people who work there, and there are many businesses who are very worried about the Conservatives' position on a referendum on the European Union, and there are many smaller businesses, for example, a small textile business that I met yesterday in the East Midlands, who want to see that cut in business rates because that's one of the biggest costs facing them and their
right.
business. So those are our priorities, tax cuts for ordinary workers and for smaller businesses.
And important as that is, and the magnificent work that they do there, you're not concerned about the bosses of Primark, Iceland, Ladbrokes, Costa Coffee,
well, more
Mother
than
Care,
half of
Pizza Express,
more than
LK
half
Bennett,
of people
Ted
work
Baker.
For small businesses. More than half of people work for small businesses rather than big businesses.
Right.
This letter today to the Telegraph is specifically about corporation tax. As I say, I don't think it'll be a surprise to people that bigger businesses want to see their taxes cut. We've committed to have the most competitive rate of corporation tax in the G7, but when there's limited money to go around, we think the priority should be tax cuts for ordinary workers and for smaller businesses.
Lastly, Rachel, a bit embarrassing that Peter Grau, the chairman of Bloomberg, signed it. You were only in his place on Monday with Ed Miliband. It's embarrassing, isn't it?
And Bloomberg are keen that we remain in the European Union.
Well, never mind that. I'm talking about this letter that he's signed. That's so embarrassing.
Well,
on Monday,
letter,
you were sitting there having his drinking his water and sucking his Fox's glacier mints. And on Wednesday, this letter pops up.
Well, businesses have different views about different issues. There are many big businesses who want us to remain in the European Union and support Labour's policy on that. But,
all
of
right.
course, big businesses want to see a cut in their taxes. We've committed to having the most competitive rate.
Good to have you back on, sir. If the Labour Party triumphs in 6-7 weeks' time, what would it mean for Britain? Good morning.
Well, we don't know what it'll mean for Britain, but the omens aren't good. And the important thing we have to remember, Nick, and by the way, good morning.
Morning, sir.
What we have to remember, Nick, is that this country has clawed its way back into prosperity again. We mustn't. It's nearly fixed. We've got more work to do, and we mustn't jeopardise that progress.
What is the work that has to be done?
Well, you know, we've still got the issue of the deficit. We've still got the issue of making sure that we return ourselves to being a robust economy. There are issues that we have to deal with. There will be tough decisions, whatever government's in power after May, and everybody knows that. But what we're saying is that what we have done so far and what this government has done so far have been the right things to do, and we must continue with that progress. Don't stop now.
The Labour Party are pointing to the fact that they believe that they have tremendous support from small and medium-sized businesses, and as you will be aware, Lord Rose, they are, if you put them cumulatively together, massive employers. How do you respond to that?
Well, listen, you've got 100 or so people signing this letter. I don't want to score points, but since you've mentioned it, there were 5 people who signed a letter to the FT the other day. I mean, you know, the statistics answer themselves.
Would you describe Labour as being unfriendly toward business, or how would you characterise it?
No, I don't think they're unfriendly, but I have to say, as a businessman myself, I mean, I have had very little contact with Labour. So, you know, if I am one of the business people in the UK and you multiply me by others and other people have had the same sort of feeling, then, you know, that's how the feeling that Labour may not be as responsive to business as it maybe could be or should be starts being propagated.
In a related story to do with the election, Nick Clegg will later today promise new fathers 6 weeks of paternity leave if the Lib Dems gets into government for a second term. Again, as a businessman, how would you respond to that?
Well, I have to say, as a businessman, I think that's quite difficult to deal with. We've had over the years progressively more time for parents. And, you know, I absolutely understand the need for parents to be able to settle down with their new child. My son's just had one in Australia. He's had paternity time off, and that's part of their regulations that they have there. And clearly it's not right that when my son was born 34 years ago that I went straight from the hospital back to work. But there has to be a balance. And the most important thing is to remember what are the effective regulations that we need to put in place that are not going to jeopardise business, because businessmen need to run businesses and you can't have it when nobody's around all day.
Isn't the reality then, lastly, Lord Rose, we probably need more businessmen and businesswomen entering into politics, the reality that they could bring to the game?
Well, listen, I've always had a little bit of a motto that businessmen make lousy politicians, and politicians, by and large, don't practice much business. But at the end of the day, you know, horses for courses. I do what I do, they do what they do. But this is an important election, Nick, and by the way, stop calling me Lord. I've known Stuart for a long time.
I have, Stuart, now you've said that.
This is an important election, and choices have to be made, but this country is in a good place at the moment, and we've got to make sure that we don't jeopardise that. That's the really important thing, that as we look back after the election, that we've made the right choice.
You look far too young to be a grandfather again, Stuart, I can't believe. But congratulations.
Grandfather twice over.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on Breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on Breakfast here on LBC.
Let's speak with Transport Secretary Patrick McLaughlin for more details on that. How can you be so sure of this, Mr. McLaughlin? Good morning.
Sure. Well, we heard what Ed Ball said, and it is quite right that we challenge to say, you know, what is your future as far as infrastructure? He talks the talk on infrastructure, but actually, when the Labour Party were last in government, they were very bad investors in our infrastructure. We are investing massively in our infrastructure. It does cause problems. When you're doing these big upgrades, people are inconvenienced. But at the end of the day, we get a far better transport system. Look at what's happening with Crossrail across London. Very important indeed, a massive infrastructure programme that's been on the cards for 30 years plus. It's actually now being built and will be completed in 2018.
Many of my listeners, though, will have battled in on trains, perhaps from Hertfordshire and from Kent and from Sussex, with old rolling stock having to stand in fairly cramped conditions, and they'd rather see some of that money improve existing services. Why don't you do that first?
Well, we are spending £38 billion in the next programme at the moment on improving our railway network. So we're going to see a huge amount of new trains on Thameslink, the Siemens trains coming into operation in 2018. Crossrail is being built, will be operating by 2019. You know, so what I would say, and I well understand the frustration as well that many passengers have about the work when we're improving the network. I understand that frustration, but it is the fact that we're upgrading it so we get a better system, so that the signalling is much more reliable, so that we have extra capacity. I mean, the problems that people have had to suffer at London Bridge have not been acceptable, but we will increase massively the capacity there. We're basically rebuilding that whole station. It does come with problems. There are problems while you do it. If you've got a house and you have improvements, you have inconvenience while you're having those improvements. That's exactly what we're doing on the rail network.
I understand that as a result of HS2, people can get to Birmingham, I think it's 16 minutes faster than currently they can. How many businessmen or women have asked you to be able to get to Birmingham 16 minutes faster than they currently can?
It isn't a matter of speed. Speed is a plus. It is a matter of capacity. The West Coast Main Line is one of the busiest railway lines anywhere in Europe. You know, over the last 15 years, we've seen freight on our railways rise by 75%. I want to see more freight on the railways. I want to see more freight having the option of going on the railways. one of the issues which will prevent that from happening. Not next year, the year after. We're talking about 5-6 years down the line. One of the things that will stop that from happening is actually capacity on the rail network. So that is absolutely essential. So if you accept that there is a capacity problem, if you look at what's happening on train journeys north and south, east and west, vast improvements in numbers going up. If you accept that, then you've got to start thinking, how do you plan for the long-term future of our country? And that's exactly what HS2 is about. Don't forget, HS2 was actually conceived by the last government right towards the end of its period. We've taken it forward because we've said, yes, we've got to invest in infrastructure.
Just lastly, on the matter of this debate that's taking place later tonight, why was David Cameron, the Conservative leader and Prime Minister, why has he ducked the challenge of going one-to-one with Ed Miliband?
He's not ducked the challenge of going one-to-one. As David Cameron has been answering Ed Miliband for the last 5 years in the House of Commons. But he's also said that the debate isn't just about what the leaders do, it's about the debate in the rest of the country. So we don't want the television debates completely overshadowing the whole of the election campaign. So there are plenty of opportunities for David Cameron to be quizzed by members of the public. There's plenty of opportunities for the leaders' debates that are taking place. I think that is, you know, perfectly the right way to go and absolutely the right thing to do.
I knew him as Anthony Selden. He's now Sir Anthony Selden. He's Master of Wellington College. Indeed, he played a hand in educating my two sons. So it's good to speak to you again, Anthony. I trust you're well, sir.
Yeah, Nick, lovely to see
you. Good to have you on. Let's take you back in time. I know it's only a few years ago when you were a schoolboy yourself. How happy were you, Anthony?
Well, I was brought up in London. I was at Dulwich, and as a boy, I don't know if you think very much whether you're happy at school, do you? I mean, I don't know about listeners, but it's not kind of a thing you think about actively. Am I happy? But you do kind of look back at it, and I just think it's so depressing, the idea that your school days are going to be the happiest of your life, because there's, you know, like, what's there to look forward to if that's the best? And I think for many kids, actually the experience of school is far from happy. And yet it can and should be much better than it is. And we're doing some fundamental things wrong in our schools that I think are correctable. And we need to get sorted out because we have a duty to try and make all our young people as happy and secure as they can be.
And you explore this in a new book, and we'll give details of that book in just a moment. So you're at the coalface, Anthony. What are you doing then? Or what have you done? I appreciate you're perhaps coming to the end of your tenure now as a head teacher.
Right.
But what have you done at Wellington?
At Wellington College for 10 years, we were teaching happiness or well-being. And now this was really scorned, Nick. I mean, lots of newspapers and radio shows ridiculed us when we started doing this. But it's grounded on really serious research, much of it in the positive psychology department of Pennsylvania University and elsewhere in the States, and now Cambridge and Oxford have departments focusing on well-being. What can you do to bring up children so they're going to be psychologically secure, healthy, centered, and so they have the best possible chance in life not to be frightened and intimidated, but to be really well grounded in the human beings that they are. So that's what we do a lot of. And then I founded a body called Action for Happiness. If you go to the website, viewers or listeners will see 10 different ways of making yourself happy. And that's, I think, a responsibility, because if we're happier, we are more useful to other people. If we're unhappy, we kind of drain energy.
What's the distinction between happiness and pleasure?
A really big difference, Nick. And that's, I mean, I love agreeing with you because you always have me back on when I agree with you. But I don't totally agree.
It's a bit of a sideswipe there, Anthony, but do go on.
This is the last time I'm going to appear on your show. Because you said that the first paycheck makes you happy. I'm not certain that how far money really makes us happy, or physical possessions, new cars, holidays, a drink and a nice meal. I think they give us pleasure, But that's very different. I mean, happiness comes from, you know, what you talked about also, which is, you see, Nick, I am praising you there, you know, having children,
yeah.
relationships, being loved, being respected, going for a walk, seeing the sunrise or setting, you know, feeling a sense of goodness and harmony with oneself and healthy and harmony with others and with the environment. These don't cost any money, and they don't consume material. It's a much more kind of human or even spiritual experience. That's the difference. So pleasure always consumes, costs us money, fades over time. We need more and more drink or bigger yes. cars to make us feel pleasure. But happiness is a really profoundly human and a wonderful experience that all of us can experience more.
Coming back to the profession, the education profession, I have a note here. You were speaking at the Oxford Literary Festival and you said that education authorities have played, quotes, a cruel, vile trick on children because of the pressure regarding exam results. What did you mean by that, Anthony?
Well, what is slightly misquoted, but what I actually said and meant is that if we make children believe that the only thing that matters in their life are exam results, then that is a cruel, mean trick, because there are many other things that matter in life. I think what's important is for children just to do their best at these exams. But, you know, we hector and badger kids into thinking that it's all that matters and their only worth in life is assessed by exam results. Of course they're important, but they're not all important. Young people have many, many different intelligences. Let's ask, how is a child intelligent rather than how intelligent is a child? Because every single child has different kinds of intelligence, and that's what good schools should be doing, finding out, and when they do that, they'll make the children and their parents and the school happier places.
Lastly, you get a telephone call on May the 8th or 9th or whatever it might be, and the new Prime Minister says to you, you know, I've been following your career and I've read some of your books and I appreciate the work you've done and you're one of the nation's most prestigious schools. So, Anthony, give me one thing I need to change or do or facilitate or install in the sphere of education. One thing, top of your list, Anthony, says whoever the Prime Minister might be. What would you tell him or her?
Valuing young people and teachers for who they are, showing them trust and respect, giving them space, and introducing calm and stillness, mindfulness in the heart of schools, which would just allow them to be much securer, more joyful places.
Always good speaking with you. Thanks, Anthony. So Anthony Seldon, Master of Wellington College. Check out his latest book, Beyond Happiness. It is out now. This is Nick Ferrari. More highlights of my week on breakfast after the news. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC. Today about how a Conservative government will create many, many more jobs. How many and how would they be created? Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Nick. What we want to do is do what was done in this Parliament in the next Parliament, and that's creating 1,000 jobs a day, and that would mean across the next Parliament an extra 2 million people in work in our country. In this Parliament, we've done 1.9 million extra jobs. We've created more jobs than the rest of the European Union put together. How have we done it? Well, we've invested in apprenticeships and skills. We've been building the roads and railways the country needs. We've cut tax for business and attracted inward investment into our country. And if we stick to that plan, I believe we can create 1,000 jobs a day in the next Parliament.
And I can hear critics wailing, Prime Minister, they'll all be zero-hours contracts. How would you respond?
Well, first of all, the figures are that one in 50 jobs is a zero-hours contract. And, of course, we're the first government in history to legislate, to outlaw exclusive zero-hours contracts. So we want to get to a position where, you know, people only have a zero-hours contract if they choose to have one. I want jobs there, and most of the jobs we've created are full-time jobs. I want jobs there that people feel they're really building a strong livelihood for themselves and their families.
People are saying this is going to be the tightest election in generations. What do you think is going to be the key determining factor when people go into that ballot box in May, Prime Minister?
Well, it's obviously an election on a knife edge, but the truth is the country faces a very stark choice. I think the big choice is, do you want to stick with the team and the plan that have turned Britain round and helped put the country back to work and help us to finish the job? Or do you want to put all that at risk with Ed Miliband, who thinks that the answer is more spending, more borrowing, more debt and more taxes. And I would argue those are all the things that got us into the mess in the first place. And so stick with the plan and stick with the team and we'll take the country through this.
Reflecting on last week's interview on television, Andrew Marr has said Jeremy Paxman is a genuinely tortured and angry individual. Is he correct, Prime Minister?
I've no idea. I don't really know Jeremy Paxman well enough. Look, he's a very good individual.
And I think, unfortunately, we've lost the Prime Minister. It's one of those things you're never really going to get back, but there we are.
It is a problem, I think, for many schools. Actually, this is a way of raising standards, because pupils with EAL nationally do about as well as pupils whose first language is English, and obviously they have to overcome some barriers to do that. They also make more progress from their starting point than pupils whose first language is English. And I think that the things that help them actually help all pupils. So you find that where those pupils with English as additional language are doing well, so are other pupils. So schools have to make a few adjustments, but it's actually an advantage to have children like this.
Diana Wilson, who's from Oxfordshire and is a delegate at the conference I mentioned, is quoted in the Times as saying, and I quote directly, "Imagine the scene. There's Carla from Portugal on the left of me, limited English, but we communicate through the little Spanish I have. There's Barbara to the right. She's Hungarian. We communicate through pictures, sign language and symbols. There's Titania in front of me, a Russian girl with an emerging knowledge of English." She goes on, "I was up until midnight writing individual lesson plans for three EAL students and two other differentiated ones for the rest of the class." And she talks about the complexity. And you don't see that as a challenge?
I think it's a challenge. But I think the kind of children you're dealing with are likely to do very well, so it's very rewarding. That's a scenario that lots of people are familiar with. They've been dealing with it for a very long time. One of the issues that teachers face, I think that reporting gets to some of it, is that initial teacher training just doesn't cover this issue at all. And given that we're talking about over a million children in our schools, it really ought to. I think there's a review of it going on at the moment, and I certainly should be writing to it, suggesting that we should have more in initial teacher training about pupils with English as an additional language, because everybody's going to face it.
But I don't see why you can't accept it as a problem.
It's a challenge, but I don't think it's a problem. And the reason I don't think it's a problem is because these pupils do really well.
Yeah, they do really well, but obviously some of the children who are going to have to except their teacher gives extra time to Carla from Portugal and to Tania from Russia, they're obviously not going to do so well because the teacher's having to give so much time to people who don't understand English. Of course that's a problem.
Well, we don't have any evidence of that. That's a bit of anecdote. But the evidence, when you look at the big numbers about how well children do, is that that's not the effect if teachers are well prepared. We also know that the things
You're telling me that a classroom in London or any other major city in this country, not today because the children are on their Easter holidays, but a teacher who's having to try and get through with some sign language to a Hungarian girl and a bit of French maybe to a girl who's come from Africa, girl and something else for a little boy who's come from elsewhere, you see that as a positive benefit?
I'm telling you that in London, where we have the largest numbers of these children, children with English as an additional language do better than other children. And they
but what about the other children?
Raising standards. The other children do very similarly and they do better than they do elsewhere in the country.
All right, here's another delegate, Joy Wilson. Joy Wilson.
Talks to the lessons to help them, it helps everybody.
Joy Wilson says EAL pupils are arriving, she's a teacher, I'm sorry, EAL pupils are arriving with increasing complex needs such as speech language communication disorders, autism, moderate learning difficulties. They take longer to unpick when you have language as a factor. Again, Mr. Smith, it is a problem.
It's a challenge. But it's a challenge that can be overcome. There are some very complex issues you've just mentioned there around assessment. And obviously, that is more of a challenge to work out whether there's some kind of speech and communication difficulty if you don't know the language. But it can be done. And actually, I don't think there's evidence that there's a lot of that happening at the moment. There will be some children like that. They've got very specific needs, just like children whose first language is English, have speech and communication difficulties. And there are things you can do to help them. But it's a relatively small number. Overall, what we have are lots of children whose parents are incredibly keen for them to learn, who give them lots of support, and who make very rapid progress and quite often improve a school's overall results.
All right. Well, let's see what the mums and dads, and possibly some of the children themselves, it is Easter holidays, by the way, make of it. Graham Smith, you run the EAL Academy, a consultancy and training service. No, it's not a problem, says Mr Smith. He is at the front line.
Oh, I think the Conservatives are very good at getting these letters together, and Lord Rose, a Tory peer, has done it before. I'm sure he'll do it again. And they will need their own counter-letters at some point. From Labour's point of view, they'll probably be economists, because economists, by and large, certainly the academic economists, they back Labour's plan to invest rather than cut on capital spending. So, yes, there is some embarrassment, but I've looked at that list, and some I'm sure will make Labour wince, such as Bob Dudley, the head of BP, but then we'll see others such who signed it, such as Stuart Rose, a Tory peer, and they'll just shrug him off.
A bit embarrassing that the chairman of Bloomberg has signed it as well. Ed Miliband and a couple of his other heavy hitters were only at Bloomberg on Monday talking about business.
Yeah, no, I giggled at that too. But of course, you've got to remember they talk about reducing the deficit. Actually, the plan over the last 5 years, George Osborne's achievement, he's reduced the deficit by less than Alistair Darling intended to do it for Labour, because of what happened in 2010, 2011, when they raised taxes and they cut investment and growth was snuffed out of the economy. Of course, it's back now. We can argue about who shares it. But with the people who sign this, there is also an element of self-interest. I mean, they kind of are an amalgamated society of fat cats. They're a bosses' trade union, and at the back of their minds, when they're signing this letter, will be their own tax rates. And they know, I've looked at that, and I suspect there's not one name on that letter who earns less than £150,000 a year. They're in the top 1% of earners, and they know Labour will increase taxes on them. Labour's not going to increase taxes, or they haven't said they're going to increase taxes on other people, but they will on them. And I wonder how many live in houses worth more than £2 million, so they'll fear the mansion tax. So there is a large element of self-interest when they sign these letters.
In the previous hour, I read the following to Rachel Reeves and asked her who wrote it. It goes, Labour's case in 2010 was that the Tories would put the recovery at risk. If 30 chief executives employing thousands of people in companies worth billions of pounds say it's Labour that put the economy at risk, who does the voter believe? Answer, the chief executives. Once you lose them, you lose more than a few votes, you lose your economic credibility. So said Tony Blair, which makes it, as you say, even more acutely embarrassing, doesn't it?
Oh, God, there's a few former Labour donors on that list, who've gone over. But kind of business backs, whoever they think are going to be in power, they go around pretty much as a posse. And who are the Labour big business backers? Well, Lord Sugar, but he's been very silent recently. They rolled out Martin Taylor, who's a hedge fund manager, gave him £600,000, because this Bill Somebody, as Ed Balls famously forgot the name of a guy called Bill Thomas, who used to be a director of EDS. Sam Alam, the whole city, owed a big engineering company too, and he may not vote. Labour's got problems in this area, unquestionably. But when most of the electorate go, do you go vote for your boss or do you go vote for yourself? Because Stuart Rose, Lord Rose, the Tory peer, one of the people who signed this letter, earlier today came out against any laws restricting 0 hours contracts. Now, that 0 hours contracts might benefit people like Lord Rose, because it means people could be employed dismissed at the drop of a hat. I'm not sure it would benefit any British worker who needs a steady income to pay the rent or mortgage.
Always good speaking with you, Kevin. Thank you. I know we'll speak again during the next 36 days or whatever it is. Kevin Maguire, Associate Editor of the Daily Mirror, a freelance reporter based in Hong Kong, who joins me now. So do we know what might or might not be on these documents that they're after? Morning.
Hi, good morning, Nick. I'm not sure exactly what might be on these documents, but it's understood from before that there were some 200 pieces of evidence that the prosecution needed to go through.
I see. And so how much extra time do they get now?
Right now it's been adjourned until May the 8th, so a few weeks.
They get a few weeks. Okay, and how much coverage is it getting on the local media?
It's had a fair bit of coverage because something like this doesn't happen every day in Hong Kong. The murders were, shocking.
I can imagine. And so far, how far have we got? How much of the prosecution and indeed how much of the defence has been laid out so far?
Well, really nothing at all.
Nothing's been done
so far. It has yet to be made. Nothing has been done so far. It is due to, well, the committal is due to start on May the 8th, and that's when we'll hear a lot more.
All right. Okay, thank you for that. Just to remind you, Jutting is charged with the murders of Sumatri Ningish and Senung Mujashi. Police were called to Jutting's property on Halloween night and first found one of the women with wounds to her throat and to her backside. She died a short time later. The body of the other woman I mentioned was found in a suitcase. The two women were in Hong Kong as domestic workers, but were working in what's termed as the local sex trade. That case will run and run, as they say. This is Nick Ferrari. More highlights of my week on breakfast after the news. This is LBC.